Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Yeah.
And NPR.
You just want to lunge in?
You go first.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today on the show...
Well, this is a whole hour about ghosts. I guess you could call them ghosts, because...
It's more of a haunting kind of show.
Yeah.
Because these are stories of possession.
Yes.
We've got a story of a man whose dreams were possessed by a boogeyman, and then...
A machine that is occupied by a saint.
And then a dead woman who lives on in a form that many of us have sucked on. Really? I mean, actually, not in a sexual way, but...
No, not at all.
I want to save your life kind of way.
Right.
And we start with a story that, you know what, I'm just going to read you something.
Okay.
It's from author Mary Roach, and it starts like this. What happens after you die? I can name you 47 men who've tried to harness the rational horsepower of science to answer this most floaty question. Some were physicians, some physicists, some psychologists. Two were Nobel Prize winners. Of them... Only one, to date, has landed irrefutable proof. Man's name was Thomas Lynn Bradford.
Yes.
And that is Mary Roach.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Jed?
I'm good. Mary is the author of several books with wonderfully succinct titles.
Spook, Stiff, Bonk.
Those are three different books. The one we're talking about today is Spook.
The subtitle is Science Tackles the Afterlife.
Which brings us to Mr. Bradford.
Thomas Lynn Bradford was a spiritualist who lived in the early part of the 1900s.
A spiritualist, is that...
Spiritualism was a religion very popular around the turn of the last century that was predicated on this notion that there is no death, that when you die, you just go on to Summerland.
Summerland.
A beautiful place beyond.
The thing is, spiritualists like Thomas Lynn Bradford, actually especially Thomas Lynn Bradford, they didn't just have faith that Summerland was out there after death. They wanted
proof, physical evidence that there is a beyond.
So here's what happened. One day, when was this, by the way?
This was 1921.
One day in 1921, Thomas Lynn Bradford put out an ad.
Yes, he put an ad in a Detroit newspaper.
Which basically said, I would like to prove the existence of the afterlife. Anyone out there that can help?
I'm looking for other like-minded people to think about this. And this one woman contacted him.
Really?
A Ruth Moran.
Who is apparently a psychic.
And the two of them sat down and they devised what they thought was an ironclad plan. One person dies, crosses over to the afterlife.
And then from the beyond, that person would yell back.
Hey, it worked. I'm here. There's an afterlife.
Meanwhile, the person who didn't die would be sitting in a room somewhere, psychically listening. To see if they could hear something.
Because if they could, then we'd have our proof.
Huh.
In fact, I think it was that evening, Thomas Lynn Bradford, in his rented room, he turned on the gas with the pilot off, and... asphyxiated himself. The New York Times reported this whole thing.
Detroit, February 6th. Thomas Lynn Bradford committed suicide last night. His body was found in his room at 2500 Howard Street with the gas turned on.
The landlord in his building found him the next day.
Nearby were found several typewritten pages on Can the Dead Communicate with the Living? Somewhere in Detroit is believed to be a girl who is waiting for him to answer this question.
The girl, of course, was Ruth Moran, the psychic. And there she was, across town in her own small apartment, with the lights off, as I imagine it, just waiting.
Listening. But... she didn't hear anything from Thomas Lynn Bradford.
Detroit, February 7. Though more than 40 hours have elapsed, no message has come back from the spirit world to Mrs. Ruth Doran.
There was a follow-up story the next day. The headline said,
Dead spiritualist silent.
It was almost like when somebody is lost at sea, they wait a certain amount of time, and then they finally say, okay, we're declaring him dead.
Yeah. But you know what's weird is, like, this Ruth girl, right? Why wouldn't she just lie and say that she did hear Thomas Lynn Bradford?
I know, that's...
I think it's very admirable to be honest like that.
I think that people like Thomas Lynn Bradford and Ruth Moran, they weren't trying to pull a hoax. They weren't charlatans. They really were just seekers. They really just wanted to find proof.
Huh. But you say, you said in that thing I read, you set him up as being the guy who knows, the guy who found proof. Were you just being colorful when you wrote that?
No, I mean, he knows in that he's dead now.
Oh, I see.
Dead people know.
So this isn't really like a knowing problem. It's a journalism problem.
It's a reporting problem. Billions of people know. They just can't get the answer back to us.
Huh. Okay, that brings me to my last question. In your book, Spook, in the dedications, you say, to my parents, wherever they are or aren't. At this point, after writing this book, are you willing to say that they are somewhere or that they aren't?
If I had to put my money on it, seriously, if a great deal was at stake and I had to decide one way or the other, I would put my money on they aren't anywhere. But that's really depressing, and I don't want to have to put my money on it.
Yeah.
And I don't like to be the sort of person who even says that, because, you know, my mother believed. My mother absolutely had faith that when she died, she was going to heaven. And even if she's wrong, she doesn't know she's wrong. So she went through her whole life with a calmness and a peace of mind that I'll never have. The people who believe win. The skeptics lose.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. What was good enough for my grandpa?
Thanks to Mary Roach, author of the book Spook, and many others.
That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
Our next story is a little different. Now, we've just met a person who couldn't come back. This is a woman who did make it back from the other side, but in a very strange form.
You've probably seen her.
Really?
You've seen her face.
Oh. Comes from our producer, Sean Cole.
You may have even
dated her.
Well, put your mouth on her.
Explain.
So, you know when you got to bring somebody back to life?
One, two, yeah. Three, four.
They make
five,
you take a class.
Six,
yeah.
And
eight,
they make you practice on this dummy.
CPR, yeah.
And the dummy has this face.
That you suck on.
Well, you don't suck on it. You blow into it.
That's what I meant.
You don't know a lot about CPR.
No, right. Well, what's the story with the dummy?
So that lady.
29, 30.
Before she was a dummy, that face belonged to an actual woman's face.
The CPR dummy's face is an actual lady?
An actual lady that was transfixing and inspiring to millions of people and used to basically hang out with Napoleon and Mozart.
What?
Come on.
True.
Yes.
I first heard this story from this guy, Jeremy Grange.
I'm a producer with BBC Radio in the UK.
He made a documentary about all of this a while back. But basically, our story starts in Norway in the early 1950s. There was this toy maker named Asmund Leerdal.
I mean, Asmund Leerdal was making plastic toys, brightly colored toys.
And this story also involves
his two-year-old son, Tore.
I'm Tore Leerdal.
He's all grown up now.
Well, obviously, I don't recall the details myself, but it's been told to me that
he and his father, Asmund, are at their summer home, which is on the ocean. And somehow, Tor toddles his way out of sight, and the next thing anyone knows,
I was found floating face down in the sea. And I was just kept floating by some air trapped in a raincoat.
He's on top of a raincoat on the water?
So I think the raincoat is on top of him, but basically it's keeping him aloft.
So there's a bubble of air underneath.
Yeah, and then Asmund, his dad, sees him.
I don't know how long I have been in the water, but when I was pulled out by my father, I was life less.
And not only does Asmund not know mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
This was in 1954.
There is no mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
I mean, no, people didn't know about it.
It hadn't really been developed yet. And so his dad...
He was shaking me and...
doing whatever he could.
Gradually, I responded.
And as fate would have it, not long after that, Asmund, having freshly saved his son from drowning, is contacted by the man who is developing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
An Austrian doctor called Peter Safer.
We had worked out all the basics of CPR with the mouth-to-mouth and the compressing the chest and everything like that, but...
He realized he needed a way for people to practice this, and...
My father was asked whether he possibly could help making some kind of training device.
And pretty quickly, Asmund thought, well, we need a dummy.
And Asmund had to decide what the face of this dummy was going to look like.
Should it be a woman? Should it be a man?
I think he felt that people would be more intimidated or shyer if it was a man's face, so he decided to go with a woman's face.
An attractive woman's face.
Because at that time, you were asking lay people to blow into a quote-unquote dead person.
You know, you don't want to blow into somebody who's gaping with a horror face. She should look comfortably dead.
And then he came across this girl in my grandparents' home.
Asmund is there in the house, and he looks up at the wall and sees this face of a woman. It's a mask.
And my father was taken back by the beauty of this face.
And he says, that's the face I'll use.
This is a mask? So what kind of mask was this?
It was a death mask.
What's a death mask?
All right, I'm gonna go back even further here, so stay with me for a minute. Back in the 19th century, commonly, people, after they were dead, they'd have masks made of their faces because you want to preserve their countenance. So right after the person dies, pretty much, you take a bunch of clay and you stick it on their face and you make a mold, fill the mold with plaster, and then you've got a plaster mask and you can reproduce it and reproduce it. It was especially common in Paris.
Hey, Radiolab. It is a sunny, cold Paris October morning. And
of all these mask makers' workshops that existed around Paris 120 years ago, there's only one left.
And we're about to visit
called
Lorenzi's, which is a mask making shop. So I'm coming up to the gate.
We asked our friends Kristen Clark and Tamara Sredojevich to drop by there for us.
They've still got this incredible workshop, and you go up some rickety, narrow wooden stairs, and you get to the top, and there's just banks of faces.
Rows and rows of people that look like they're sleeping.
Death masks of...
Who is the one at the top there?
Everybody. No, Napoleon.
Napoleon here.
Where is he?
Robespierre.
Robespierre, he was in the French Revolution.
Mozart and Beethoven.
That's the mask of Chopin, the composer.
Looking at you from the wall and from the ceiling.
I mean, all of their eyes are closed.
Face after face after face.
And they're all famous.
Historical figures. But also among them is...
this girl. She's not a poet, she's not a conqueror, she's not anybody.
Well, she's got to be somebody. I mean, who is she?
Well, the story that emerged after she died, and this is maybe fact, but the sources are lost to us, so we're not sure exactly what happened. But she was young.
You know, in her early to mid-20s, came from the countryside.
She's not from Paris.
You know, she was a sort of poor, uneducated woman, but she came to Paris.
Meets a man.
And there was a love affair.
Which then turned sour.
The story is that maybe she was pregnant and abandoned, or maybe she was just abandoned.
She goes to a bridge that's stretching across the Seine. Might be the one by the Louvre. Steps to the edge.
And she threw herself into the river. Drowned. And then the body was recovered.
She was taken to the morgue, which wasn't that far away. And in those days,
bodies would be displayed behind glass, and hopefully their relatives or their friends would come along and say, yes, that's my father or my sister or my daughter. And she was this particularly beautiful corpse, and everybody rushed down to see her. And eventually the guy who ran the morgue took a plaster cast of her face because she was so beautiful.
He was just struck by her, just like Laerdal, just like everybody.
So, what does she look like?
Yeah.
Quite a, I wouldn't say a sort of plump face, but a rounded face.
She's lovely, but not in a come hither way. She's more like sort of weirdly saintly looking.
Like she's serene?
Innocent, maybe.
Serene, innocent, but also sort of knowing. And she has
a little smile. If you look at the mask, there's just this little smile playing on the lips. And it's just enough to kind of make you think, well, why is she smiling?
And
who is she? And
the problem was,
she wasn't identified.
Unless they didn't know.
No. And so ultimately, people started calling her by this name.
The Ankonu.
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 What does that mean?
Well, so, you know, like the word Ingenu, which means innocent lady, like the character of the Ingenu in the movies. This is L'Ankonu, which means unknown woman.
The Ankonu de la Seine, the unknown woman of the Seine. And then gradually the plaster cast worked its way into the mask makers' workshops and out onto the streets of Paris.
And it wasn't long before this woman became a sensation. And everyone started writing about her.
The face of the young drowned woman,
Rilke,
was beautiful because it smiled so deceptively as though it knew.
Anais Nin.
The woman who had drawn herself here years ago and who was so beautiful that...
Nabokov.
Touchingly frail young shoulders.
Who wrote this entire poem sort of demanding, you know, who made you jump?
Who was he?
What, you know, who was the guy?
I beseech you, tell me your mysterious seducer. Was he some neighbor's curly-locked nephew of the loud tie and gold-capped tooth?
In any case, this mask is a huge deal and all thousands, countless people have it hanging on their wall. The same way you would hang Napoleon on your wall because he's Napoleon, yeah. But they don't know who she is, and that's sort of the point. They're like, who is she? And everybody's captivated, including our toy maker, Åsmund Lærdal.
He felt that the Ankonu,
the attractiveness and the story,
would be the right model to use.
For the first CPR mannequin in history, who has a name?
Resusian.
Could you describe what we have in front of us here?
Well, what we see is the very first production model of Resusian from 1960.
She's had to check. The face has changed slightly because if you want to do CPR, you have to have an open mouth. So, regrettably,
the slight smile is now parted. Yes.
But you've still got the high forehead and the closed eyes.
Wow.
And
every Resusian CPR mannequin that's produced.
300 million people have been trained on this thing since it was first introduced in 1960.
Has the face of the Ankonu.
Still.
And hopefully she's looking quite attractive.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
The craziest part about it is that this face of this drowned woman becomes the face that people blow into to learn how to save drowned people. So it's like, it's like over and over and over again.
12, 13, 14,
thousands and thousands of people are trying to bring this woman back to life.
That's kind of beautiful.
That's kind of nice. Yeah.
The only issue maybe is every fact you've just given her isn't really given about her.
What do we actually know about this woman?
Well, so I mean, Jeremy went into his research sort of asking the same question. Well, what do we
really know?
What do we really know? What's true?
I have a horrible suspicion. The truth, you know, is that she didn't die.
What?
Having shown the mask to Pascal Jacquin, who's a member of the Brigade Fluviale.
This is the river police whose job it is to pull dead bodies out of the Seine and rescue people from the Seine. And Pascal is in charge. So
he's seen, you know, hundreds of drowned bodies. He can look at a face and he can know whether that's somebody who's drowned.
And he said,
it's surprising when I saw the picture to see that so peaceful face, just because everyone we found in the water, it's never so peaceful.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but when somebody's drowned, they start decomposing quite quickly.
They are swollen most of the time, so
the features that you would have seen in life don't really last very long.
It's not so nice looking.
Once somebody's been in the water.
Do you think she's attractive?
Yeah, yes, of course, yeah, yeah. Just she looks really graceful.
So if she didn't die, then...
Who was she then?
She may have been a model that somebody just thought was pretty, wanted to take a plaster cast of her face. I mean, it's really, at that point, it's anybody's guess.
We don't know this?
This is our end of knowing.
It's our end of knowing. Well, it's frustrating.
But maybe it's better that way. I mean, if you don't, like, the reason why she was so captivating is because people don't know and they can just fill this gap with their own stories. They can just sort of sit there and muse about her. In fact, Jeremy told me this story about this museum that he went to in Liverpool. It was at the historic house of a photographer there. And
in the kind of waiting room, there was the mask of the Inconnu actually on the wall there. So, you know, slightly disingenuously, I asked the guide, oh, what's that? Now?
Very disingenuous. Yeah. Well, then you knew everything about it at that point.
I thought I'd see. And it was amazing. She told me this story about twins, two girls from Liverpool. And this is the important bit, from where we were, from the city where we were.
Not from anywhere near
Not from anywhere. Exactly. And
the story was almost exactly the same, except this time one of the twin girls left Liverpool in her late teens or early 20s, made her way to Paris, fell in love, got knocked up, the guy left, she despaired, and then
threw herself off the bridge and drowned, and the mask of this beautiful corpse was taken.
But this version keeps going after that. 50 years later, the surviving twin, who never knew what happened to her sister, takes a trip to Paris.
He's walking through the streets of Paris and sees this face on the wall. And yeah, this time, instead of it being her own face, it's the face of her twin sister who's there. And so her twin, who died long before her, is kind of kept forever young while she's had to age. And so she's from Liverpool now, as far as, you know.
As far as the Liverpudlians are concerned.
Yeah.
And I wonder if she's also from Cornwall, as far as the Cornwallians are concerned, and from, you know, like...
Maybe she's a Muscovite, as far as the people in Moscow are concerned.
She's Sicilian, as far as the Sicilians are concerned.
Maybe she's a Laotian, as far as the Laotians are concerned.
And a Buenos Airean.
Maybe Australian.
How about Calcuttan, as far as the Calcuttans are concerned?
Beirutian, as far as the Beirutians are concerned.
Let's go a D one. Let's go a D in.
Denverite, as far as the Denver people are concerned.
Yeah.
Dalatian, as far as people from Dallas.
Producer Sean Cole. And before we go, thank you to Jeremy Grange and to our readers, Pike Malinowski, Maureen Boudot, and Jeff Spurgeon.
And special thanks to Lisa Morehouse and Michelle Canu. We'll be right back.
This is Jeremy Grange.
Hi, this is Mary Roach.
And here are the credits.
Here I go. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation
and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by NPR.
End of message.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, it's about being haunted, ghost stories.
Yeah, next we have a story that's... It's not so much a ghost story. It's more of a facing... How would you put it? A facing...
Your boogeyman, I think.
Yeah.
But in this case, like, literally.
Yeah, that's...
Almost.
Almost. And it comes to us from... Matt, you ready?
Yeah.
From reporter Matthew Kielty.
Steve.
Yes.
And another guy.
How you doing? I've never been better.
So, Matt, I don't know exactly how we're going to start this story, but maybe
just
introduce us to this guy.
So this guy's Steve Volk. He's a reporter, a city reporter here in Philadelphia. I write about courts, crime, politics.
But the thing that I read was a personal story of Steve's. Story starts with Steve in his early 20s, and one night he goes to sleep.
Right. So I have this dream where I wake up in my apartment. There's nobody there but me. And I'm just sort of pacing around the rooms. And I feel that kind of tremor or buzz almost, that something bad's about to happen.
That feeling when like the walls kind of close in on you a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I could just feel that something's about to happen. And I look over at the window and there's this face.
outside his window.
This man.
Just hovering there.
And then he sort of recedes back into the dark. And comes back again. And so it sort of bobbed up to where I could see it and then recede back into the distance. And it was very, very threatening.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening. I just think that this person's trying to scare me, intimidate me.
So he waits there for a minute. And a moment later, Steve hears this knock.
Uh-oh.
At his front door. He knows immediately it's this guy.
And so I start hollering, using every expletive I know. You know, you're gonna scare me. I start daring him to come in so I can kill him. And I have this rage that, you know, I don't know that I've ever really felt in real life. So much rage that it made me feel sick.
He's just screaming at the door over and over.
Come in here so I can kill you. It was really violent.
And then all of a sudden, this guy just kicks open the door.
And we fly at each other. We're both swinging and grabbing each other.
And then
I wake up, literally with my fist, you know, my hand balled into a fist, and I've just thrown a punch at the air.
And he's in an just absolute panic.
Very, very profoundly disturbing dream.
But it's just a dream.
Yep. But the thing about this dream is that it wouldn't go away.
Meaning?
Like, any time there was any sort of anxiety that flared up in his life, work deadline, relationship, family troubles, it's
back again.
And every time, the same thing.
This face that comes up out of the dark.
The face, the window, the door, the fight.
You know, I wanted it to go away.
And so this is something, this persisted for how long?
I would say I had this dream at least 6 times a year for about 20 years.
20 years?
20 years.
So he must have had it like
hundreds of times.
So yeah, it was a dream that I wanted to be done with. And I wasn't sure how to be done with it. But
a couple years ago, Steve starts working on this book, basically looking at things that are kind of out there on the edge of science, but he's looking at them in this objective, investigative way. And one of the things that he ends up bumping into is
lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming. So this is where, like, you wake up inside your dream, like you're awake.
You're awake, you're present, you're aware, you can control what's happening in your dream.
Now, let me just ask you, like, really? I mean, I've seen Inception, I've heard people say that they have lucid dreams, but I just always assume those people just don't know what they're talking about, that they're actually referring to something else.
Yeah, it seems crazy, and for a long time.
Western science denied lucid dreaming happened.
Yeah.
It didn't exist.
But the more Steve looked into it, he realized that, like, the science behind this is real.
It is.
Yeah, so
sell me.
We're gonna start with this guy, Stephen LaBerge.
Stephen LaBerge.
So in the late 70s, LaBerge goes to Stanford. He wants to study consciousness. The reason he does is because he's grown up his entire life claiming to have lucid dreams.
He claims he's been controlling his dreams all his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's also a scientist.
So he had to find a way to show people objectively that lucid dreaming exists.
Wait, hold up. How would you even go about doing that? Because if it's a dream, it's only in your head. So how can you prove something that's only in your head?
So that actually takes us back to LaBerge's advisor.
A guy named William DeMent.
William C. DeMent.
DeMent.
And he's conducting all these sleep studies at the Stanford Sleep Science Center. And one of the things he notices is when people go into this dream state, their eyes, behind their eyelids, they begin to just
dart around like crazy. They go diagonally, sideways.
Basically what we know is REM. Or
rapid eye movement.
Right.
But one day, DeMent has this subject, and he's watching this guy, and this guy's eyes, when he goes into REM, out of nowhere, his eyes go from craziness to this, like, really slow, controlled pattern. Left to right, and left to right, and left to right. And DeMent
was so intrigued that he immediately went and woke them up and said, "Do you remember what you were dreaming?" And they said, "Yeah, I was watching a ping pong match." Ba-dum-bum, right? I mean, it sounds like a joke.
But for LaBerge, this is like a total revelation. I mean, think about it. If you are in a dream and you like wave your hands around or you shout, you're not moving or anything on the, you know, in the real world. But if you move your eyes in a dream, someone sitting out there in the real world will actually see your eyes move. They'll see that. It's like this little hidden line that you can use to call out from the dream world to the awake world.
And so Stephen LaBerge figures, okay, what I'm going to do then is have somebody monitor me while I sleep. And once I'm dreaming and become aware that I'm dreaming, I will issue two smooth, controlled eye movements.
In other words, I'm going to go to sleep. And when I become lucid in my dream, I'm going to move my eyes left, right, left, right. And then you, out here in the real world, you'll see my eyes actually move left, right, left, right. And that way, you'll know that I am lucid in my dream, controlling what's going on.
That's pretty cool.
So LaBerge gets all hooked up to the machines, and his assistant sits there watching his eyes go all crazy. And then
suddenly, instead of herky-jerky movement,
his assistant sees
smooth, controlled movements.
Left, right, left, right, left, right.
The same pattern they'd agreed on.
Exact same pattern.
And they were sure that LaBerge was deep asleep during this pattern making?
Yeah, yeah. They were watching. They were watching on the EEG machines that he was in a deep sleep when he made that pattern signal.
So he was conscious while he was unconscious, is what you're saying?
Correct. He was lucid.
Okay. And he was able to repeat this?
Yeah, he went on and ended up replicating this with a lot of other people.
He published it?
Yeah, he published it.
Like in a journal, not just on the web.
Yep.
Wow.
And you won't find, at this stage, you won't really find credible dream researchers denying the reality of lucid dreaming.
So
you will find them ignoring it routinely.
Steve gets in touch with LaBerge, who turns out is doing these workshops now, teaching people how to have lucid dreams.
How to have lucid dreams?
On command.
This is something you can learn?
You can learn how to do this, yeah.
LaBerge has discovered a lot of different techniques for this.
He's got techniques.
What are the techniques?
So first of all, to become lucid in a dream, you have to realize in the dream that you're dreaming.
Yes.
Which is kind of like, how do you
do that in a
dream? Well, what you do is you practice in the waking world. You become like hyper aware of certain things that work differently in the dream world than they do in the waking world.
Like what?
One of the most easy for people to follow is print.
Like text. When you're awake, text is text. But text in a dream
changes really dramatically
from moment to moment.
Right now, there's a ViewSonic monitor across from me. And when I look away from it and look back, it still says ViewSonic. However, in a dream, when you look away from it, because it has no external reality, when you look back, it could be anything. It could be nuclear launch codes. It could be poetry.
The point of all this is to zero in on things that make you question,
am I awake or am I dreaming?
It's called a state test.
And what ends up happening if you start doing this in real life is you end up being in a dream, and because you've asked yourself this question a dozen times that day, am I awake or am I dreaming, that thought will occur to you in the dream.
And if it does?
That might open the door to actually becoming aware and taking control.
Man, you are more than halfway there at that point.
So Steve, he started trying all this out, doing all these state tests, but it wasn't really working. So he ended up calling LaBerge's assistant.
And I called her, and we talked through different techniques in the book, and then we talked about this nightmare.
And when she heard about his nightmare, she actually suggested a different technique.
In waking life, imagine the dream as it happened, and then find the point at which you would like to gain lucidity. Something happens, something shifts, and this is the point where you'd like to become lucid.
And he decided, when the face first appears in the window,
that's the moment.
That very specific moment.
When I want to gain awareness. And so I would imagine myself doing this over and over.
Face, awareness. Face, awareness. And then, one night, he goes to sleep.
I'm walking through my apartment, nobody there but me, and I feel that sort of
familiar
buzz of anticipation.
Something bad's about to happen.
And I look into the window, and there's the guy.
Just like usual. But this time he says,
I was there.
You're there, and then suddenly you're there?
Yeah. It's like my perspective shifts, and I am in this body, in this place. Not observing something, but in it. So I could feel, you know, my fingers tickling my palms. I could feel my feet on the floor. I locked into these feelings because they make the dream more stable. And I wanted this dream to be stable because this face has been showing up in this window for 20 years. And it does its thing. It recedes. It comes back. And I go to the door and I reach for the door and the handle is a door handle. It feels that real. And I turn it and I... Bam. A moment or two later, the guy appears in the doorway. And there's this moment where we look at each other face to face and he's this total nondescript guy.
Really?
Like any old beer-drinking dude. So he looks at me, and he's clearly perplexed because we're not going through our usual dance. You know, and I kind of backed up to give him room.
Guy walks in.
And we're standing there looking at each other. And I hadn't thought about what I would actually say. I just thought I'd let him in.
What does the guy do?
Well, he pulls out a gun. At this point, when he pulls this gun out, the whole dream in this moment now becomes for me a kind of battle between what I know to be true, which is that this is a dream and it has no external reality, and the natural feelings of fear that crop up when somebody who's already been terrorizing you for 20 years has now pulled out a gun. And he is really carefully looking at me, like waiting for me to go back to my normal reaction. So he pulls the gun up now and points it at me, looking at me like, okay, now are you going to do what you usually do? You know, now are you afraid? And in my head, I'm just like, it's a dream. It's a dream. It's a dream. It's a dream. And so I just stand there. And he starts firing. My first reaction is to look down at myself, right? To look at my chest and my stomach. And I can see that my shirt is just sort of billowing with each impact. With each bullet. But there's no blood, there's no nothing. I'm not hurting. I am taking this. And it's nothing. I really feel, and I had this thought at the time, I'm Neo. I am Superman. This guy's firing bullets at me and nothing. I look up at him and he sort of looks at me. And then he smiles and drops the gun by his side. And the sensation I had was like that message was like, see, you got it. You got it. I'm nothing to be afraid of at all. And I woke up still feeling like Neo, still feeling like Superman. And I have never had that dream.
It's
never had it again. It's gone.
It's gone.
That dream is gone.
Well, thank you, Matt.
Hey, sure.
And thanks also to Steve Volk. His book, which goes into much more detail on lucid dreaming and many other things, is called Fringeology.
This puts me in mind of a solution to a problem I've had now for several years, you know.
Like me beating up on you in your dreams?
I should have just waited it out, really. I should have said, yeah, go ahead, stab me.
See, now I'll never hurt you again.
I mean, this is something that everybody can take home and use tonight.
All right, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Shawin Alaria, and I'm calling from Piscataway, New Jersey. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Today on Radiolab,
it's ghost stories.
Yeah.
And this one, well, this one is going to take us into a machine.
All right. My name is Latif Nasser.
He's not a machine. He's a grad student
in the history of science department at Harvard.
But he did get us thinking about really old robots. One in particular that was...
Actually, it was kind of haunting.
So the year is it's 1562. This is 450 years ago.
Not so long after Columbus.
Yep. Ferdinand and Isabella are dead, and there's a new king of Spain.
Philip,
yeah. And he has a son.
The 17-year-old crown prince. His name's Don Carlos.
And one day...
he's in the royal lodgings. He's walking down a flight of stairs. He trips. He falls. He bashes his head against a door near the bottom of the stairs.
Mm. This is the crown prince, you say?
The crown prince of Spain.
So this is a national calamity.
It is a national calamity because he's the heir apparent, right? So, at first it doesn't look like it's such a bad injury. He's still conscious, but then his head starts to swell to this kind of crazy size. He becomes delirious and feverish. He's struck blind.
Ooh.
And so at this point, the king comes, right? This is King Philip II. So he is at this time, he is the most powerful man in the world, right? So he basically controls all of the Americas. He controls much of Europe. The Philippines is named after him.
He was tight with the Pope.
At this time, the Pope and the king were kind of like, you know, BFF. Yeah. So the whole Spanish court is going nuts. Across the country, people are seeing this, reading this as a kind of sign that that God's very angry,
yeah.
Right? And so they're fasting, they're doing these kinds of prayer processions, things like this.
And according to Latif, the king calls all the best doctors in Europe to come to Spain to help his son. And these doctors are trying everything.
They are drilling a hole in his skull.
To relieve the pressure?
To relieve the pressure. They are bleeding him and blistering him, and they are purging him to the extent that he has like 20 bowel movements within just like a certain few hours. They're like smearing all over the wound. They're smearing like turpentine and honey.
Man,
and
poor Don Carlos.
But even after all of this, they sort of look at each other. They look at him, and it's kind of like he's gonna die.
So he's dying.
Yeah, he's basically on his deathbed.
So, at this point, according to Latif, the king goes to his son.
Legend goes that he kneels beside his son at his son's deathbed, and he makes a pact with God. The pact is, if you help me, if you heal my son, if you do this miracle for me, I'll do a miracle for you.
Wow, that's quite hubristic of a human being to say to God.
Well, let's also remember that he's the most powerful man in the world at this point.
He is a god among men, really.
Yeah, hubristic or not, this is what he says.
Yeah, okay.
All of a sudden, his son just gets better.
Really?
Within a week, he can see again. Within a month, it's as if he didn't fall at all.
He just pops right back up?
Yeah.
And King Philip must have thought, well, my God, this is
amazing. My God. It's probably exactly what he thought. And when his son can finally speak, he says to him, Dad, you know, the weirdest thing happened when I was out. I had this dream.
Oh, that's a great story.
This is Elizabeth King.
I'm an artist and a professor in the sculpture department at Virginia Commonwealth University.
And she's actually the one that hooked Latif on the story.
Yep.
In any case, the dream.
There are documents of Don Carlo next morning saying that he had had a dream.
This vision.
That a figure.
In a Franciscan habit.
Shaved head.
Sharp nose.
This marvelous monk.
Entered his room.
And approached his deathbed holding a cross and basically told him, you're going to be fine.
And that's quite well documented.
Apparently there was a witness in the room.
In the sick room. With him that night.
Who overheard the prince talking to a ghost, sort of mumbling things in his delirium.
So, Don Carlos has this dream. Suddenly he's fine. And the natural question that people are asking is, Who is this monk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just a generic monk or is it somebody specific, some messenger from God?
And from his description.
Physical description. And
the shaved head, the
pointy nose, the monk's habit.
Piercing eyes, even the kind of cross he was using. Everybody in town, the king, everyone was like, oh yeah.
Like, we know exactly who this guy is.
Can only really be one guy.
Kind of local friar who died 100 years before, named Diego de Alcala.
Diego de Alcala.
Who is he?
He is a local holy figure whose corpse was associated with a number of documented miracles.
In fact, this guy was so holy in this town. Mm-hmm. Actually, not just in the town. You want to know something? There's a bit of trivia. Ever heard of San Diego?
California, you mean?
Yeah, as in the Padres.
What does he have to? Is this the same guy?
Same guy. He was the patron saint of the people who founded San Diego.
He is holy.
There you go. So he was so holy in this town that people believed his corpse, his 100-year dead corpse, had healing powers.
And some people, there are different stories, but some people say that even they,
that unbeknownst to Don Carlos, that night that he had the dream,
the priesthood and the king himself, according to some stories, went and they got this corpse out of the church, out of the crypt. They carried it through the streets. They brought it to the bedroom. They
literally put it, they sort of snuck it in bed with Don Carlos, and that's how he healed.
They didn't stick him in bed with his bones, right? They brought him into the room.
There's different reports, but there's a picture of it in this engraving.
Oh.
And if you can, you wait, probably can't see it, but look at this picture right here.
She had a copy of a 16th, roughly a 16th century woodcut showing you this scene.
Where you could kind of see.
Oh, wait, so there he is. Oh, my God, he's in bed.
They're dunking him over the bed.
He's in bed.
The two men in bed together are about to be.
Well, they could be, you know, they could be just laying him down.
Okay. Yeah, it was caught in the middle.
We're seeing it a great
Meanwhile, back to our story. You got Philip II, who has asked God for a miracle. God came through this monk, and now Philip II is like, uh-oh.
I got to deliver. King Philip II owes God a miracle.
Yes, he does.
And he's acutely aware of this. So basically what he does is he enlists this really renowned clockmaker.
A clockmaker?
Yep. Named Juanello Turiano.
Juanello Turiano.
Yeah.
A huge man. A big ox of a man. Described as always being filthy and blustery. And not a lot of fun to be around. But a great, great clockmaker.
Certainly among the best.
In Spain.
Maybe the entire Holy Roman Empire.
So the king goes to this guy and he says, look, I want you to make a mechanical version of Diego de Alcala.
What?
A mechanical version of this 100-year dead holy priest.
Yes. Like a mechanical monk.
A robotic padre.
Yeah.
Which, and this I did not expect, still exists.
Now the monk bot is in the Smithsonian, perfect working order.
No way.
I swear that it's since 1977.
No.
Yeah.
The first time I saw this figure, I was drawn to it and then repelled.
That's Carlene Stevens. She is a curator at the Smithsonian in D.C. About a week after Latif and I spoke, we ended up in D.C. meeting with her, and she showed us the monk, who lives in a little glass case.
What we have here is an automaton, over 400 years old.
Is this the first robot that we know of?
No,
idiot.
The ancient Greeks had things that could be considered robots.
Okay, back to our story. 450 some odd years ago, our clockmaker, what's his name?
Turiano. He goes into his shop and he does whatever he does.
Connects one gear to another,
for hours.
Weeks, months.
No idea how long it takes, and I don't think anybody does.
But he emerges one day into the bright sunshine with, what did you call it?
A robotic padre.
Yeah.
It's a 15-inch high
figure
made of wood and iron, has the sort of habit, has the sandals, has the rosary, has the cross.
Yeah. And poking out of the top of the habit is a little
bald, hairless head
with that sharp nose like a razor.
And the rather ferocious eyes.
Like intense or like doing business ferocious?
Like, I'm focused.
I'm focused.
Like, maybe I'm only 15 inches tall, but I am focused on something much bigger than you, you human.
So did you, like, turn it on or push something?
Yeah. Then why would I get on a train and go for 3 hours just to look at it?
Obvious question.
Okay. Do you want to mind it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do it.
So Carlene takes us out into the hall. We sit down on the floor. She gives Latif a little brass key. He sticks it into the secret slot in the monk's side.
And I think it goes counterclockwise. You would tend to want to do it this way.
And Latif winds up the monk.
And I'm turning it counterclockwise, and it's surprisingly sort of taut. How much should I turn?
And so, if you sort of wind up this sort of secret spring.
I think there's a stop and it'll.
Okay. All right, I'm going. I'm going.
Put it on the ground.
You wanna just
all right.
Let him go?
Yeah.
Give him a push.
It'll walk very slowly.
One foot after the other, coming out from under the cassock. In fact, there's actually little wheels under there. But yet you see the feet coming out. The head is turning from right to left. The eyes are rolling in the head. The mouth is opening and closing.
As if it's sort of muttering like a prayer.
The arms are in motion. One arm is raising and lowering across. The other arm is beating the chest.
Wow.
A symbolic gesture.
To a Catholic.
That is called the mea culpa.
After three or four steps, the arm holding the cross does something new. It moves two different new directions to bring the cross to the mouth, and the figure kisses the cross.
It's
oddly like mesmerizing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The next thing it's doing is that it's turning and moving in a different direction and then walking its paces and kissing the cross.
As we watched it, it turned once, then twice, then three times, four times, and then it got back to where it started.
So if you imagine a table with a number of people sitting around it, probably it's going to sort of, at one point or another, head for you. And then turn away and head for someone else, and then turn away.
Why would the king of Spain, who could have, you know, I don't know, built a church or taken a crusade to Jerusalem or done something, you know, he could have done anything. Why did he decide to commemorate his son's revival by making a little automatic doll? Like, what was that for?
Yeah, Latif, what was he thinking?
Yeah, it's a good question.
That's the $64,000 question.
It's a great question.
It's a really good question.
The truth is, there's really no way to know for sure.
And as a historian, I gotta rely on the documentation.
And there's not a whole lot of that in this case. But one interpretation certainly could be that, you know, the king had this amazing, miraculous thing happen to his son. And now he had a way of sharing that with his subjects. Because he's got this device where it's an illusion. Like, the machinery of it is completely hidden.
There's no visible. That's one of the craziest parts, that it's all sort of hidden underneath the robe.
So when he put it down on a table or in a courtyard, people would have seen it move on its own. They would have been amazed, as we were. And he could have said, look, here is the miracle. Look what God did for our country.
God likes Spaniards.
Yeah, look at what God did for Spain, which would have been a useful thing for a king to be able to say, right?
Yep.
That's one possibility. Yeah. The other is that just on a more utilitarian level, this was a machine that was built to pray.
And this was a period when you could buy prayer repetitions.
So if you had the money,
you could get someone to pray for you while you go do something else.
Yeah, that's so cool.
So you're covered.
You're covered.
And if you think about it from Philip's perspective, he needed to say thank you to God. And here he had this thing that, if he wound up, was an automated thank you machine.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, it could be thank you, thank you, thank you.
Or it could be,
I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Yeah.
It could also be, I'm sorry.
Or it could be, please, 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 please.
Whatever you need. But if you think about it more expansively, says Latif, like, what did it mean at that time to be a Catholic? Like, what did it really mean? Well, then this robot was maybe the best Catholic you could ever hope to be.
What counted as prayer was quite specific, in the sense that if you say the right things and do the right actions in the right order, in the right time, and in the right place, sort of that's prayer. That's when God notices.
So it's about method.
It's about method. It's about...
And maybe this monk, he says, was like method embodied.
That's a good one. I mean, why not?
Right.
It is, in fact, perfect. it repeats itself right. over and over and over, and it replicates the ideal.
So it's basically what it is
a little teaching object.
Like, this is what you're aiming for.
Here's how you do it.
Like, this is it. This is the perfect prayer.
The perfect prayer.
This is doing it the perfect way every time. And I, because I'm just this, you know, lowly, imperfect human, I'm not, I can only aspire to this perfect piety.
Are you making this up, or do you think that this might, the monk might have actually been seen this way?
It could be true. I don't think it's so crazy.
Especially if you think about what was happening at that moment. And this is Counter-Reformation Spain, right?
Not so long after Luther, you know, is nailing his theses on the wall.
And there's this big debate raging about how actually do you get closer to God?
You have the kind of protesters with Luther who are saying, it's not about, you know, works. It's not about saying something this many times. It's about whether you feel it. And then you have the kind of Catholic argument, which is to say, you do these rituals because these are the rituals. And these are the way you get, this is the way you get close to God. This is the way you pray.
You pray like this thing.
Just like this thing. And if you're a Catholic king, and if God's a Catholic, you better hope he is.
And if you're Philip II, you look at the sky, and you say, God, you and me are square.
Special thanks to Latif Nasser and to Sarah Abdulrahman for her production help on this story.
Thanks also to the amazing Elizabeth King, Carlene Stevens at the Smithsonian, and to David Todd. He constructed a replica of the monk, which is actually what we heard moving around. Huh. Because the monk itself is very old and you don't want to be winding that thing. Mm-hmm. But big thanks to David Todd. We couldn't have done this piece without him. And actually, he and Elizabeth King will be publishing a book soon, which is called...
A Machine, a Ghost, and a Prayer.
The story of a 16th century mechanical monk. And thanks lastly to Stephen Vitiello, who recorded clock sounds in David Todd's workshop, which we used in the piece. Huh! I am exhausted from those thank yous. So much gratitude.
And of course, thank you for listening.
Yes. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Bye.
Hello, hello. Latif Nasser, Steve Volry. And the Credit Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn,
Thorne Wheeler, Pat Walters, Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Melissa
O'Donnell, Dylan Keith,
Lynn Levy, and Sean Cole.
With help from Daisy Rosario and Nadia
Wilson. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks.
Thanks very, very much.
See you guys.
End of mailbox.